renegade economist is saying, yeah.
Economics for activists. Economics is being made. Economics. These are the tools activists need. How can we calculate? What motivates people? Why do people spend money? Understand the basics to economics.
Don't you love young minds that can speed you up, push you further? Well, we've got one today. His name is Stephen Spadischer. He gave the keynote address at last week's annual dinner. And watch out as we fly through current geopolitical issues. Yes, the law of averages copped the Fitzgerald household this week. We were burgled. Yes, late-breaking Father's Day disaster. All our computers and a hard drive full of treasure troves were nicked. So whatever you do, back up your digital photos and store them off-site. That is the hip tip from the Renegade Economists. Hopefully insurance will come through, but a bit of devastation. Yeah, much angst, but luckily the druggie's been busted and is in remand now awaiting jail. But yeah, when are we going to legalise some of these drugs, stop people like him making his daily burglary fix? All right, we've got this interview with Stephen Spadischer. Wow, was I impressed. He is fast-paced, so sit back and hang on. This was recorded the day after our annual dinner last week. Fantastic to see over 50 people there chewing up this young man's beautiful insights. Here we go. I'm here with Stephen Spadischer, who gave the keynote presentation at last night's 119th annual Henry George commemorative dinner. Stephen, welcome to the Renegades.
Pleasure to be with you, Carl.
Okay, now you gave a very dynamic talk last night, screaming through all sorts of issues. Can you tell us about Ben Bernanke and what is going on with the US economy compared to Japan?
Well, there's actually not very much difference between the two. America's just had their real estate bubble burst, as we all know. The Japanese during this time are basically telling the Americans, whatever you do, don't do what we did, and they did that. They increased interest rates just as the housing bubble, or as a response to the housing bubble that was taking place, you know, with property prices going up by as much as 30%. Now, the problem is you owe debt. You owe more than you are worth, and when that happens, businesses and households go away from profit maximization to debt minimization. That's not in the ordinary economic textbook, and when that happens, it essentially means that investment and consumption does not occur and instead goes to meeting obligations of the past instead of being able to invest and look towards the future. It's backward looking instead of forward looking, which is completely contrary to what most economic textbooks tell us is the rational assumption of a consumer or a business.
How is Japan telling them? I miss those stories.
Well, through central bank conferences, you know, they usually organise these sort of things, you know, international conferences. The Bank of International Settlement had also come out with similar sort of warnings. And in just good old economic history, I mean, good quality economists, whether here in Australia, you know, we've got Steve Keen, for example, Michael Hudson in America, most of them had the hunch that this would take place. So they were in the academic arena, in the professional corporate sectors, and in the banking and institutional arrangements, they were all being warned that this was going to happen. It happens every 18 years. They knew it was going to happen. Well, they certainly know now. But they did nothing about it.
Is America going to suffer from a similar 20-year recession?
Most probably. Yes, because if you look at the data, they've never had as much debt as they've had now. Now, if you correlate the growth rate, so the less debt you have as a percentage of GDP, the quicker the economy will recover. The more debt that's incurred, the less the economy doesn't recover as quickly. So if you go back to, the 1973-75 recession, the recovery was very quick, even though you saw similar sort of vacancy rates and collapses in housing output. You go forward to the 1990s, the recovery was a slow, joyless recovery, to use Clinton's phrase, and then you go forward, and our recovery now has been extremely slow. The recession's almost been going on for 3 years. That's to be contrasted with the 18th month recession that you saw in the 1970s and the 1990s, because it lasted only a certain amount of quarters. So as a result of that, people are now paying off debt. They've got these obligations that are serious. The obligations have to be met, unless they default, which creates its own set of problems. You know, banks aren't going to lend, which creates other problems in terms of credit constraints and consumer constraints. So that is part of the problem. Now, the corporate sector and the household sector both owe more than they are worth. They're in, you know, they're underwater. So that I want to emphasize is what the American corporate sector and households will be doing for the next decade, getting their balance sheet in repair. So we're in a balance sheet recession, and Richard Koo coined in the Japanese experience, and that's basically what America's going now. The only thing that will stop it from collapsing will be budget deficits, who really do attack the symptom rather than the cause of business cycles. So budget deficits will stabilize growth, but the growth will be joyless, it will be very flat. You might even see a lot of quarters with negative output and negative growth, as certain sectors are just forced to liquidate because they haven't got the cash flows to meet their past debt obligations.
So the 70s was widely blamed as an oil price shock. You've got a radically divergent view on that.
That's right. I mean, you look at the data. The first claim is that interest rates were lifted because the oil shock caused inflation, which caused the central bank to lift interest rates. Now, that's the Bernanke view in one of his papers. Unfortunately, the increase in interest rates started 9 months in most countries before the oil shock. And in fact, most of the countries were citing the property boom. And one statistic I forgot to mention last night, but it was quite radical, was over the from 1970 to 1973, the advances to the property sector increased by 640%. That's terrifying. So that you can understand that when they, in the UK, for example, they had the Competition and Credit Control program, which was designed to revamp the manufacturing sector. Unfortunately, most of that money did not end up investing in the manufacturing sector. It ended up investing in property, and that's how they got their property boom. So that same sort of stuff, ideas are observed in Australia. Whitlam, you know, specifically recognised that the rising in interest rates before the oil shock was there to target the property boom. You see Japan, another 30% rise in residential property in 1 year, and a 43% rise in commercial property. Again, the bank was very concerned about the speculation that was taking place there. In fact, the government had announced a very widespread infrastructure plan that was going to revamp the archipelago, new highways, new roads, all those sort of things. Speculators went and mopped the entire area up and bought that. And so you can see why in Japan as well there would have been a land speculation boom. In addition to the worldwide deregulation that was taking place, the property bond had come onto the market. These were all worldwide trends. And in America, of course, the real estate investment trusts was where the boom. So that was one argument that, oil shocks cause the downturn because of a rise in interest rates. The central banks were targeting a property bubble that was taking place. Other claims include the wealth transfer effect. Money is recycled and given over to Saudi oil barons. Unfortunately, the problem with that is most of that money was recycled back into the form of real estate in most of the domestic economies, so that argument doesn't stand. The other suggestion is that automobile consumption would have collapsed as a result of the oil shock. Again, there in Australia, it actually increased right after the oil shock, quite a pronounced increase historically as well. So that in America, on the other hand, that started taking place, decline, 9 months before the oil shock. And in fact, right after the oil shock, the consumption of automobiles stabilized for a little while before it resumed its negative decline and then had a swift recovery. And it should be noted that in subsequent oil shocks, car sale consumptions and all that sort of stuff was actually fairly stable or increased as well. So that there should be a degree of symmetry if, you know, oil shocks cause car sales to fall. So all the data seems to suggest that at best the oil shock had no impact. At worst, the impact that it did have was probably secondary. Oh, and my personal view is actually it was completely neutral. If anything, actually had a positive impact because it gave us a little bit of inflation that will validate debts as well, because inflation allows you to pay off your debts quicker. Or it actually increased output because all these companies were starting to invest in fuel-efficient cars, and the local sectors, energy sectors, were actually starting to employ people. So the argument that oil shocks caused a 1973-75 recession is a bad view, a more monetary George's view that looks at land and finance and the interaction those two have in output, explains why you had all these property companies like Cambridge Credit, Mainline Corporation, you know, the real estate investment trusts liquidating worldwide, and certain manufacturing firms in Japan that had gone into the speculative frenzy of the 1973-75 recession. So that's what you observe. It's not oil, it's real monetary factors that determined the fall in output in that particular recession.
So how on earth did this myth evolve? Why was it pushed forward that oil caused the 1970s shock and the resultant stagflation?
I think part of the problem was the simple correlation equals causation assumption. It looks nice, it's neat, you know, it must be that. So there's this presumption, oh, well, generally a little bit after, a little bit before a recession start, there's oil. Of course, the problem with that is if the oil shock happens after the recession started, that indicates, you know, that's not quite correlation equals causation. But it's neat, it's symmetrical, and people like things to be symmetrical. The other problem is that in neoclassical theory, there is this presumption of business cycles not being caused endogenously. You have to blame some external cause because the market's perfect, the market is able to communicate prices automatically, smoothly, with generally perfect information. There are now some caveats to that and other theories that have recognized market failure, but they don't talk about asset prices very rarely. They don't talk about debt. They don't talk about the land market, and that's completely ridden out of the equation. So they instead focus on real factors such as supply side shocks or demand side shocks, or basically external shocks, not endogenous shocks. So it's a theoretical sort of reason why they presume these sort of things.
You've talked a lot about debt. Is debt a cause or a symptom of these downturns?
Well, let's think about this. If you're an economy and you've got low debt, and the economy's doing pretty well, you know, you've got a strong external sector, the government's building infrastructure to keep up with the capacity of the economy. Now, which market do you think will succeed and go well? It'll be the land market, right? Because, you know, families now go and buy their own home. The asset prices in that particular, well, the price signal, rather, in that particular asset are particularly good, just from general prosperity. Now, notice here that the causation here is from the land market, then people wanting to go into debt by going to their bank. So it's general prosperity in that market that causes people to take on debt to speculate or just to, you know, ripen and sort of, you know, take on higher sort of quality of life or the appearance thereof. So it's not just the debt is a symptom to the inbuilt fetish, if you'd like, for speculating in land. It's a good asset, it gives good returns, at least it gives the illusion thereof, when the economy is prospering. And now, of course, there's a positive feedback mechanism. Prosperity equals higher land prices, which causes speculation, which takes on debt, which means further increase in land prices. But there's a natural tendency in the economy for prosperity to first and foremost be deposited in the land market.
And so the obvious question follows, how on earth do we stop that cycle evolving?
Well, the cycle can be stopped through land value taxation. And, you know, a very small tax could be introduced and you slowly phase it in while you abolish other taxes. And people shouldn't fear that, particularly if when the property bubble bursts, then, you know, no one's really got any vested interest anymore, you know, for the bubble to keep propping up. But and I understand people should fear that, you know, because the value of their home will be reduced and they've got, you know, to pay off the debt that they've just incurred. But the way you stop it for future generations to be inflicting the same sort of debt peonage and bondage that, you know, they've been into with the banks, to stop that, to stop the business cycle, or certainly it's the pains. You know, I'm not saying that business cycles are only caused by land speculation. There are other causes. But what I am saying is that the great initiatory cause, as George put it, is land speculation. And that's most pronounced every 18 years. It started in the US from 18 around there, and you add on every roughly 18 years, and you notice that they face a depression, notwithstanding a world war, when the cycle can be broken. So there's this natural tendency, and that could be eliminated by not causing everyone to start going into the land market and building oversupply and all those sort of problems. Because when you build too much, construction collapses, which means manufacturing collapses, because manufacturing supplies the ingredients and the equipment needed for the construction sector, you know, steel, wood, all those sort of materials. So the economy is interlaced. Now, the reason that all these people go into that sector or willing to invest is because they're going to make a capital gain. When property prices collapse after a bubble, you basically got a situation where no one's going to build if they're not going to make a capital gain. So that is an extremely important price that people look into their calculations. But the good thing about land tax, it reduces the value of the land, but what actually you make a profit on is actual construction. And so it makes the land cheap, you quickly access it, then you can sell it to someone who will use it, and you can have, you know, certain returns on that as well. So, but that's the whole idea. It's about a quid pro quo, about rewarding production over just, you know, speculation and just sitting around, because anyone, you know, can sit around and watch their property price. But are they productive? Are they visionary? Are they entrepreneurs in the truest sense of the term? So that's one idea why land value taxation is quite good. And anywhere it's been implemented, it's worked quite well. You know, it would make sense if you're going to abolish all taxes and just tax one tax. One of the three forms of factors of production, land will be it, because if you're not taxing capital and you're not taxing income, they're free to do what they are good at doing, which is to produce, to add to the societal wealth in real terms, not just on pieces of paper.
On pieces of paper, that's a good way to sum that up.
Hello, this is Archie Roach, and you're listening to good music on 855 AM. On 3CR.
And we're talking to Stephen Spadager. He's doing his honours at ANU. And let's go back to the discussion I had with Stephen last week. We've seen over the last 20 years a rampant pace of globalisation speed up. And from my view, this race to the bottom in terms of cheaper wages has seen a dampener on inflationary effects, as everyone's trying to undercut each other with their pricing systems. It seems like we're getting close to this bottom. Do you see that inflation is going to rear its head after this race is over, or are we going to be able to keep a lid on inflation in the future?
One of the things that I should stress is that inflation, I don't see an inflation issue happening. Simply for the reason that the money supply is endogenous. You know, we've seen Ben Bernanke print, you know, as much as Japan almost printed back when it was having its issues. In fact, Japan printed 1.3 trillion, trillion, not billion, yen, and they got deflation because no one was borrowing. And that comes back to my earlier point about the notion of businesses not being forward-looking, backward and present-looking. They're about debt minimization, not about profit maximization, as Richard Koo points out, and I think that's a very interesting and pertinent distinction. So I don't see inflation being an issue at the moment. As for wages, it should be noted, though, that most wages are being deposited in the rental sector. So you get your wages, but ultimately it's going to be paying back a mortgage or going towards rent. So you see that personal disposable income falls and as a percentage of, you know, the increase in rents and mortgages and things like that. So wages are really just a means to an end. Any capitalist who wants to pay a worker can just go and get debt. But at the end of the day, what funds that is the rents, who ultimately people have to go and buy a mortgage and they have to pay those rents, you know, because the effective interest is effectively a rent, particularly when you're on a speculative market where prices are constantly rising. So wages are really the king hit by the rental market, by the property and land markets. So they're really one of the unfortunate victims of that. As for globalization, yes, but even there, one of the things that globalization results in is capital inflows in speculating in property. And if you look at, for example, the Asian financial crisis, that too was predominantly caused by a real estate boom. In fact, there's a book called, I think it's something to the effect, Real Estate and the Asian Financial Crisis, or something to that effect. And it looks at particularly Thailand, which had their boom, you know, vacancy rates hit 40%, similar sort of stuff we've seen in other parts of the world recently. We've seen, particularly in Thailand and Indonesia, that's where the property boom was most pronounced. You know, debt, predatory lending, oversupply, all that sort of stuff, you know, wealth effects, that took place. Wages also collapsed, you know, same old story. Of course, this would have repercussions on other economies. So, for example, South Korea, who although didn't have a extreme building boom as much as, say, Thailand and Indonesia and countries around there, and perhaps to a lesser extent Malaysia, would still be affected because, you know, their currency, you know, basically gets screwed over. On top of that, interest rates rise to defend the currency. A whole raft of things happen there. So even there, the Asian financial crisis and its after effects from the actual real estate boom, you can see the globalization and all these benefits the landlord. You know, all prosperity is deposited in the land market. And there's other examples, you know, recently, you know, German banks investing in US property market, Chinese investing in the Australian property market, and so forth and so forth. So you see that globalization also benefits landlords over, say, capitalists, which you would hope that, you know, capital inflows go to actually building real infrastructure and real investment, and definitely not labour, who has to pay the debt of the rising property market, you know, get into debt peonage and bondage, and all those sort of things.
In Australia now, the average house is about eight times the average wage, and many of the more mainstream economists are defending that and saying that, well, now two people are working per household, so really that brings it back to the long-term affordable levels. What's your opinion on that argument?
Well, if the two people in the household are working, why on earth should they be paying off, you know, just simple debt instead of actually consuming it in other areas like, you know, building infrastructure or investments in real capital and things like that? So what a complete waste of money, so to speak, that, you know, when they are, you know, being productive and they are going out and getting a job, they're just slaves to the local, you know, bank or some other institution. So it's just debt peonage 101. So I don't really buy that argument. I think banks are a very necessary institution. I support abolishing, you know, as a Georgist, I support abolishing taxes on banks because they do provide real working capital. And that's what banks should do. They should provide real working capital, and they're great at it, to real investments that benefit the country and benefit the long term. And I think our banks will have certain problems once and if the, but unless the government comes out with another first-home buyer's grant, which probably will. But when the property bubble bursts, they will find themselves also experiencing what Japanese banks are experiencing, namely, they've got customers who are worth less than they owe. They're not going to lend because we don't know who actually owes what. It's very ambiguous. So the credit constraints, collateral constraints, and they will find themselves in that. I mean, a bank, it might seem good in the short term to invest in property and it's great return for profit, but in the long term, I think real investment is what will actually determine the prosperity, the ongoing prosperity of a country, like a good banking system such as Switzerland, for example, where there isn't this fetish as much as there is in the other Western countries of investing in real estate. Of course, they do invest in real estate, like, don't get me wrong, but it's not a country, only 20 to 30% of the country, depending on the statistic you cite, actually own their own home. They're not into that. They're more worried about scientific investment. You know, are we going to create this? They're more worried about healthcare and things like that. And it's not surprising that Switzerland has consistently ranked, you know, in the top, the quality of human life index, as is Finland. And those countries like that, they've got, you know, broadband, fast broadband is a God-given right in those countries. You know, they actually invest in real sort of things. So those are my sort of views on that matter.
In closing, what is the most important economic principle?
The most important economic principle is that the price of land can affect commodity prices. So, for example, real estate goes up, and not just commodity prices, but also, I mean, services as well, if you want to commodify that per se. So land values go up, the services sector enlarges, so more real estate people occur, whether that's in the form of construction, lending, all that, auctioning. So that's one element. There's also people going into the market, which foregoes consumption elsewhere because they have to pay back debt. So that's the most fundamental principle of economics, that the price of land can determine economic output. And by smoothing out the volatility of that market due to speculative orgies, you basically have got a situation of being able to have constant growth without, you know, so boom without bust, notwithstanding, you know, catastrophes like the comet hitting the earth or things like that. But boom without bust. And so you have these situations that avoid paradoxes, that you can have a lot of prosperity, supposedly, but people are still very unhappy. They want more, but they don't get it. And this is, you know, in every survey, the Western world isn't happy, even though they've got a mortgage. Well, I wouldn't be happy either. I can understand that. And there's also this prosperity issue, the paradox issue of, even though there's prosperity, a lot of people aren't doing it quite well. It's not socialist, it's not Marxist, it's actually quite your sort of classical liberal, that everyone, what they create, they should own, but everything that's created by the community should be given back to the community. John Stuart Mill advocated that. Henry George, of course, advocated that. Milton Friedman conceded that land tax is the best tax. So this isn't some sort of socialist conspiracy. It actually rejects socialism in its absolute form, completely rejects it, because it's saying capital and labour is free to own what it creates, absolutely and entirely. Rents, on the other hand, and this is the great thing, we've got actually a political consensus ideologically between the left and the right on a matter, and we, unfortunately, are stunned that we cannot implement it because of the vested interests that currently govern society.
So in short, would you say scarcity is the most important economic principle?
Yes, scarcity that's precipitated through higher prices that can be manipulated by certain monopolies, in particular the form of rents, so whether they're economic rents. I mean, I like to focus on land rather than, say, mines, for the simple reason that when people sell resources, it's still doing a productive purpose. You know, it's fueling the economies of other countries, it's providing energy. Rents derived from land, you cannot say the same thing about that and say rents derived from mines. So I'm more focused on the land issue rather than, you know, mining, because I think mining companies, for the whole, while they should pay some tax in rents, they should also be have their tax burden reduced, at least for their productive investments, and depending on what sort of metals and things like that, it's far more subtle. But you know, banking is a noble business, mining is a noble business. Noble business because it does provide wealth that people need to, you know, expand their economies.
But they should pay something.
Oh, absolutely, yeah, and they've conceded as much. You know, there's no disagreement on that. But that's why I'm saying we should be focusing on land, which even the mining companies need, rather than focusing on, you know, attacking capital and income, which currently economics is doing, because they don't understand the issue of scarcity and that scarcity needs to be dealt with, and scarce resources like land need to be used more efficiently rather than being held vacant.
Thanks for listening to a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online.